San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, good evening, everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, L.A. County, up the coast to Seattle on a good night, down to Cabo, out to the desert. You can get us on your smartphone if you search It's Your Money and Your Life, and there's an app there for... you'll find it. IYMoney.com. All the podcasts are there. And now it's time to introduce the main man of the hour. He is a CPA extraordinaire. He's an accomplished marathon runner. He's a best-selling author. He's a philanthropist and a family office expert advising several high-net-worth families. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I'm marvelous. By the way, I think we're going to put a list up pretty soon alphabetically of all previous guests.
Yes,
I think that was a good idea. Courtney's going to do that pretty soon.
Yeah, on our website, in addition to the online archives of all the guests, you'll be able to find all prior guests in an alphabetical order, which would be good because if you want to find Malin Burnham or Irwin Jacobs or George Takei or Jim Lampley or name a few others, Richard, we had some...
Carl Sheeler.
Carl Sheeler, Dick Enberg. I mean, we've had quite a list there, and they're all excellent, and that's why we are an award-winning show, Richard. As a matter of fact...
October 28th, we're going somewhere. Where are we going?
We're going to the Jacobs Center again. The Press Club is having another big annual. Last year was the 40th. This is the 41st annual Press Club Awards Night. My good friend over, Mark Sauer, is up for a big award this year. He's going to get honored, let's say. But we're up in four categories. And of course, we came in first place in three of them last year. And we've already been told we've won something. They don't tell you if you're first, second, or third, but... I've got my fingers crossed, and hopefully we'll have some good results after the 28th or on the 28th, and we'll see how that goes. So
it'll be fun. We've got some guests coming, too, who've signed up.
And, you know, and I've been listening to local talk radio. I've just been tuning in a little bit this week because I know there's some transition going on at various other AM stations in the market. And, you know, I just think listeners don't want to hear yelling. They don't want to hear complaining. They get a full diet of that, and I think that's probably why our show did so well last year. We just try to... be who we are and have some fun and be entertaining and informative. And there's probably no one more informative than our guest tonight, Richard, wouldn't you say?
I would agree. And we're not going to yell. We're not going to.
Well, maybe a little bit. If we yell, it'll be in good taste. Anyway, our guest tonight, Richard, may I go ahead and introduce?
Yes, Carl Sheeler, but...
May I go ahead and...
Drum roll, please.
He's a bottom-line guy. He goes right to... Hey, we've got Colin Powell on the line. You got to build it up a little bit. So we're going to do it this way.
Go ahead, Joe.
We have a director from the Berkeley Research Group. This man is an excellent expert in valuation of business and other matters for appraisal and legal purposes, financial. And he's got a PhD, a CBA, an AVA. And his name is Carl Sheeler. And how are you tonight, Carl?
I am doing very well, Joe. How about yourself and Richard?
We're hanging in there.
In there? Come on.
Yeah,
come on.
No, we're doing great. We're doing great. We're doing great.
As always.
So Carl, you've got these, we all know what a doctorate is. I guess, I assume you had your PhD in finance or?
Correct.
Okay. And then what is a CBA and an AVA? Those are two.
The alphabet soup, ASA is accredited senior appraiser, CBA is certified business appraiser, and a CVA is a certified valuation analyst.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, wonderful.
So you have national organizations that designate?
Yes, I'm a member of two of the national valuation boards, and there's four of them. And so those are the boards that actually confer those designations to indicate that you have the appropriate skill set and education to opine on value.
Gotcha. And, of course, your website is Berkeley Research Group, which is kind of a tricky website as far as the URL goes. It's brg-expert.com, right?
Correct.
Okay.
But Carl, when you initially started as a sponsor of our show, you were somebody else. You were Business Valuations Limited. Now you're Berkeley Research Group. Could you tell us that story?
Sure. The short version is that had been playing more and more with, as you know, Richard, family business, family office, and larger private and public companies. But there's limitations being a boutique firm, even though we had a national presence. So literally as of tomorrow will be my 1 year anniversary having merged my West Coast practice with BRG, which gives me a bandwidth of a global practice with 700 individuals, of which 250 of them are considered experts in their individual disciplines.
Yeah, I'm looking at your office locations. You have about, what, 25 offices all over the world, huh? I mean, most U.S., but I see some international locations, right?
Correct. Actually, our largest location is in D.C. in the healthcare vertical, but yes.
Hmm. Bogota, Colombia, I see. I'm just going to give Calgary. I see Australia. I see London.
Correct.
Wow.
Correct.
Pretty impressive. Pretty impressive.
And what was the motivation? You just wanted to have more resources at your fingertips?
It's a really good question. The short answer is we always strive to be the best that we can be in our chosen profession. Although I believe that I had achieved a certain amount of recognition within my profession, the monetary reward is somewhat limited based on perception. So by having the term that you like, accretion, or the synergies of combining the two practices, where Berkeley did not have a vertical called the Family Business Family Office, but I had the litigation background as well, I was able to be ready to go and do work for Berkeley on day one in the litigation space. But I also introduced the vertical, as I mentioned, family business and a family office. So it's kind of a win-win, financial as well as ability, skill set. And they've also been able to provide me the ability to go from just measuring value to creating value, which, as you know, Richard, I've been working diligently to get that known in the marketplace, but this is a better platform in order to do that.
Yeah, we want to talk about that later in the show, because I think it's clearly one of the things that differentiates you as an expert in this field. And I think the measuring piece is one of the things that your profession is afflicted with in general, because I think it commoditizes what you do, and what you do is, I think, very, very valuable and can actually create significant value for people and should therefore not be a commodity, as you know, because I speak about these things in public, even though people throw things at me when I do.
By the way, I'm looking at their career page. I mean, they do, you are hiring in certain locations, right, Carl? It looks like, you know, accounting, finance, business development, consulting.
I just opened up a Denver office just a few weeks ago, mm-hmm. and somebody's there in the healthcare valuation space, and I just met with him in D.C. just a couple of weeks ago.
Hmm. Healthcare valuation in terms of what? Appraising medical practices or?
Everything from a medical practice to a multi-location hospital chain.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. That takes a while to do.
Carl, you had mentioned litigation too. I know you've frequently appeared in court to opine on issues of value as it relates to cases. Is that correct?
Correct. Really what it comes down to is several disciplines within the litigation space. The one that you're most familiar with is the arguments with the IRS as it pertains to a enterprise value, company value, or the value of the equity or the minority interest and the discounts that usually apply. But I also do a fair amount of dissenting shareholder actions, partner disputes, also mitigation as far as what should be in agreements to minimize some of those disputes that come out as a result of a poorly drafted or an agreement that's not being complied with. And then some of the bigger dollar items tend to be what's called class action lawsuits, which can be significant. So, yes.
But I want to talk about a couple of those briefly. When you talk about minority discounts, we're talking about estate and gift tax issues. Obviously, people who are very wealthy who pass away get to pay almost half of their net worth to the government as a general rule, unless they do good planning, certainly during life or at death. To the extent that we've done some good planning with the use of how we structure entities and so forth, we can reduce or even eliminate the estate tax. Could you talk briefly about how valuation
interacts in that space? Sure. There's actually two parallels there. The one parallel is when there is a dispute between shareholders, typically they're holding a minority interest, and they're suing because they feel that there's been a breach of fiduciary duty, which could be a trustee, it could be whoever has the controlling interest, it could be the board, it could be the C-suite, the CEO. But from a tax standpoint, either gift or estate tax, because of the fact that one holds an equity interest, if they don't have direct control, they may not even have voting rights. And as a result, 10% of the whole, we'll say the whole for the sake of argument, is $100 million. So holding 10% seldom is equal to $10 million or mm-hmm. one-tenth of $100 million. And the reason for that is because they don't have that control. They can't determine who's on the board or who's going to be the CEO or the frequency and the amount of distributions. So that impairment causes a certain level of discount to be applied as an investor concession to induce me as a potential investor to acquire that interest, coupled by the fact that normally we're dealing with very illiquid, privately held equity interests. So there's also a limited market and very difficult to convert it into cash the way that you can an actively traded public stock.
Right.
With discounts.
There you go.
And as long as we have the estate tax, this is a big deal.
And I
think we have to take a break soon, right? Because people were flashing hand signals.
Yeah, we're coming up on a break right about now. But there is an app for 760 KFMB. If you have to leave your radio, just download that app, folks. We'll be right back with more with Carl Shaler right after this. All right, we are back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life. Hey, there's also, we're free on iTunes, I forgot to mention. If you search It's
Your Money. I think in two places.
Yeah, if you search It's Your Money and Your Life on iTunes, you can get us for free. All the prior podcasts, all the archives are there. We are back with Carl Shaler from Berkeley Research Group, expert in valuation. And I think we've cleaned up the sound a little bit too, so haven't we?
Yeah, we sound better. We were a little bit echoey.
Well, I mean, Carl sounds better.
He sounded like he was coming down from the heavens.
Well, let's see what he sounds like. Ask him a question. Ask him a question, for
Carl,
gosh sakes.
A question. All right, so we talked about how
I know we sound good.
Yeah, we always sound great. We talked about how important valuation was to reduce estate taxes, but I know you mentioned you also work with other situations where, for example, there's simply disputes of value. I know a lot of companies, when they get formed or they get capitalized or they get capitalized over time when different rounds of investors come in, that sometimes there's disputes with regard to fairness or how things should be allocated, for example, when the company is being sold or recapitalized. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, sure. Well, there's the white hat and then there's the black hat. So the way I try to express this is, think about what a valuator does. I mean, what's the difference between a good appraiser and a great appraiser is their ability to quantify risk. You can kind of work out the economic benefit. That's usually your cash flow or your EBITDA or net income. That's the amount that you can, after paying all your reasonable expenses and still allow for growth,
right,
that you can pay yourself. So the question is that what is the likelihood of and the associated risk with being able to perform as well, if not better, in the future, irregardless of who the investor is? Well, because we're human beings, and most of the value in the majority of businesses is in its intangible assets. That tends to be issues that you won't see on financial statements, like governance and relationships and risk and knowledge. And Richard, you and I have talked about that before. So those are also human dynamic issues. So what ends up happening is, if you have a front office partner and a back office partner, and one of them doesn't feel like the other one is carrying their weight, there might be a dispute. You know what, I don't want to do this anymore. I want you to buy me out. And the other one says, sure, I'd be happy to buy you out. I'll give you 50 cents on the dollar. And the other one says, no, you're going to get 100% control as soon as you buy my 50% interest. So you should apply a premium to the value of my 50%. And that's a kind of a classic setup for some of the disputes. But what I was saying before is that's the example of the black hat. The white hat is that if you identify those risks early on, that helps on the other end, which is mitigate the possibility of those types of disputes. But you always have to start with, well, where are we at right now, like a roadmap. If you don't know where you're starting from, you're not going to know any of the things that you're going to need to determine, like time and the amount of fuel to get from point A to point B. So usually that's a benchmark or evaluation that identifies the risks as of that specific time. That's just referred to as measurement. The real In my mind, the money shot for a business owner and their advisors is the management of that risk, because as they are able to compress the level of risk, it has the corollary of elevating the price multiple in the business. Mm-hmm. Most people focus on earnings and not a whole lot on the risk, because as I expressed just a moment ago, that's an intangible, and there needs to be a strategy in place that's not just tactical. So that's part of an advisory service that we would be providing. We're not an investment banker. We don't sell any product. What we sell is lots and lots of deep dive knowledge and due diligence.
Yeah, and what interests me about risk, well, there's a couple of things that interest me about risk, but a lot of people, you know, I'll speak in front of groups of CPAs, and I'll say to CPAs, where does profit come from? And nobody ever gives the right answer. The correct answer is from risk, or from taking risk. And so there's I think sometimes people confuse accounting with finance, with economics, with
yes,
other things. And even CPAs and attorneys do that frequently, and they don't understand that managing risk, mitigating risk, understanding the risks that actually exist is frequently the most difficult task, because they're not necessarily obvious or overt to at least somebody who would just do a general reading of financial statements and so on. So it's a fascinating topic for me. I also am fascinated, and I want you to comment on this. I'll look at valuation reports that other people do, not you, and they'll opine that something is worth $40 million, but they'll never discuss the fact that there's very few people and organizations on this planet that can pay $40 million for the thing. And so certainly availability of capital and so on affects value too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So the quickest way to check whether you think that you have a value that really won't stand up is that you said if these elements would be just as true, let's say, as of March of 2009, for those of you that followed the stock market, obviously this was at the very, very bottom of the market. So there was no availability for capital. Even publicly traded companies, some of the microcap companies were trading at 70% discounts from their norm. So needless to say, privately held companies, almost no availability of capital from the debt market or the equity market. So essentially, you had many of those businesses effectively dying on the vine. The saving grace was those that didn't have much in the way of debt service or had a nice buffer of a cash reserve. The difference between what we like to say is a lifestyle business and a business where you recognize that you have concentrated risk that's giving you a level of return that you could ever seldom expect to get in the long term in the public markets.
Yeah, and that's just such a critical point. I think the other factor that's frequently missed in valuation is this whole issue of holding period.
Yes.
I think there's a very short-term focus generally with valuation. I don't know if you would agree or disagree with my comment.
And you're absolutely right, Richard, being in the family office, it must be in some ways very rewarding for you to be talking with families in terms of a 10-year hold, a 20-year hold,
a 50-year hold, right, legacy hold.
You're not thinking in terms of, geez, what's happening this quarter. Therefore, you have the benefit of being somewhat dynamic in the marketplace, creating your market as opposed to reacting mm-hmm. to the market. And I think a lot of the noise that we get from Wall Street, we don't take a step back and say, wait a second, these are mostly institutional investors that are causing these market moves up and down. These are guys with MBAs from prestigious colleges that obviously are just dealing with behavioral economics and not really company-specific risk. Until you get down at the level of that private business owner or some of the small and micro-cap companies individually, then what we're really looking at is market-driven risk and not individual risk that could, from day-to-day, change radically.
Hmm. Yeah, and what's interesting with wealthy families, they think a lot differently than, shall we say, the masses do, which is maybe why the masses aren't part of the wealthy families, and they think differently about risk. They also think differently about value.
I agree, and to some extent, it's a real shame because, as you were touching upon before, they look at the trust advisors being the accountant. They may not understand that the accountant is very good at tax and accounting, but may not be as proficient in economics and finance. Mm-hmm. So there is this invisible wall where the assumption
assumption is that you're not going to report the news. You're going to help me make the news, aren't you?
Right.
And of course, that doesn't happen. And then, sadly, in the legal community, the large majority of attorneys usually have an undergraduate in some form of liberal arts. That doesn't lend itself to really aiding the business. Their specialty is the risk to the business, not the risk within the operating business. So needless to say, there's a great deal of frustration and bad habits by owners that start getting used to the lifestyle of the capital being generated from the business, and they get unhappy because they cap out at a particular revenue range because, well, they're not putting enough back into the business to actually scale it.
Right, and so that usually means they don't have a strategy in place to
Correct.
Scale it.
Correct.
And strategy is a term that I think is frequently misunderstood, because even though people like to talk about strategy, I think frequently you look at businesses, there really isn't a strategy that goes
through. Do you find that more of a problem with inherited wealth as opposed to someone who's actually founded a company? Or
It's a really good question. As a matter of fact, I'm presenting on this next week in Napa. And what that question really is that you have some multi-generational families that have made a clear delineation between the business of family and the family business.
Mm-hmm.
So that they don't have that common phrase being referred to as shirt sleeves in three generations, which I would argue is more a byproduct that they've diluted the wealth in part because, of course, there's more people that likely are receiving that from generation to generation. But they didn't do adequate tax planning, so that takes care of some of it. But the real issue in my mind is they're not getting the level of returns they used to get when that particular asset was spinning off so much income that they couldn't even spend it all. They didn't want to spend it all. And unfortunately, I think that there is a lack of understanding by some advisors that it's not necessarily a bad thing to have concentrated risk when you have control and knowledge of the marketplace, because these guys aren't just lottery winners. These guys and gals have obviously figured something out in the marketplace, have been able to get a corner on the market, and that's why you might have the Mark Cubans of the world that are worth billions. They had a better mousetrap.
Mm-hmm.
We don't give them enough attention, candidly, in the press. We pay attention to the publicly traded companies. Ironically, many of them are still family-owned as insider shareholders.
Hmm.
Yeah, in other words, they've had what we call partial liquidity events where a percentage
Correct.
Of the company
Correct.
Went into the public market, but the family kept 30, 40, whatever percent. Yeah, you're right. I mean, outliers. People get wealthy not by diversifying. They get wealthy by taking on concentrated risk and understanding really, really well the risks that they're taking.
Why don't we hold that thought right there, though, Richard? Because
we can do that.
We have to take our long break. We'll be back with valuation expert and director of Berkeley Research Group, Carl Sheeler, right after New Sports Weather. Hang on. We are back with the second half of the award-winning It's Your Money and Your Life with our special guest, Carl Sheeler, director of Berkeley Research Group. And now it's time for Richard to thank all of our sponsors.
I'm going to thank all of our sponsors, and it won't even be in alphabetical order. It'll just be completely random. So
wow.
First of all, Berkeley Research Group, Carl Sheeler, best business valuation resource expert, not only west of the Mississippi, but also east of the Mississippi, which means the entire country.
We're getting global, actually.
We are getting global. UBS, Michael Carrancha and Drew Freitas. By the way, Art San Diego's coming up soon, Joe, in
That's
early,
right.
Early November.
I saw that.
And so we'll talk about that a little bit as we lead up
yes.
to that. Mike Carrancha and Drew Freitas, couldn't do it without you great gentlemen at UBS, right across the street, right across Prospect Street in downtown La Jolla from UBS, the best business bank in San Diego, Regents Bank, Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton. Asset protection and estate planning. We've sort of talked about that on this show. That would be with Brenda Geiger, the law offices of Brenda Geiger. Our favorite CPAs on the planet, Pluto Epic CPAs, who just survived another October 15th tax season. Always doing great work up in Vista, Don Epic and Paul Polito. Cost segregation initiatives with Joel Agreshkin, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. And related to our discussion of risk tonight, Jason Kruger, CPA with Signature Analytics, the best CFO company here in San Diego, helping businesses who don't need a full-time CFO do a much better job of understanding their financial matters. Also, Courtney Lauver, PopX Graphics, are doing a great job on the website. So thank you to all of our sponsors and Joe. People can find out a lot more about our sponsors and just listening to me blather on here, right?
Well, what they could do is get on their smartphone or their whatever computer they're using and get onto iymoney.com for It's Your iymoney.com. And there's a top menu across the top of the page, a drop down menu there for sponsors. If you just click on that, and all the sponsors are there, all their contact information, all their biographical information, everything you need to know. And they've all been working with Richard for many, many years with great success. Is that correct?
Some going back to the 1980s.
And as a matter of fact, we have to thank our listeners, you know, because I just learned a few days ago that I believe Carl's company picked up one of our listeners, learned about him from our show, and I believe he's going to have a new client. Is that right, Carl?
That is correct.
Wow. Cool stuff.
Well, I guess it works. We're doing something right.
Doing something right. So, Carl, here's an interesting thing that's happened with wealthy families over the last, 10, 12 years, as the stock market keeps doing its funny, funny things. The wealthy families, at least the ones I hang around with, they developed a rather deep disenchantment with the publicly traded markets, if not by the 2008 crash, even before that. Because they realized that they weren't in control and that the forces that were moving those markets were very short-term focused and in many cases algorithm-driven, not even driven by human beings.
Not
really
to mention
attention.
The high-frequency trading too, right, Richard?
Exactly, high-frequency trading. That's what I'm alluding to. And so some of these families, a lot of them sort of moved into what we call the hedge fund space, where they were still sort of owning the same assets, but they were sort of tying their cart to the horse, some horse that was running really, really well, so to speak, some manager that was really good. But even there wasn't that much success because frequently the goals and objectives of the general partner, the people doing the managing, and the goals and objectives of the families, the people doing the investing, weren't really aligned very well in terms of time horizon, for example. And so there was extreme disenchantment there. So there's been a movement. I think you predicted this movement maybe 5 or 6 years ago because I heard you speak about it.
Correct.
That these wealthy families, who in most cases made their wealth through what we call private equity, owning companies or owning assets that are adjunct to these companies like real estate, that they would actually move back to this direct ownership market because they love things like control and being in control of their own destiny. Are you seeing the same thing out there?
Not only is your point well taken, but there's empirical evidence of that. Back in 2008, based on third-party measurements of family offices at one event where approximately $2 trillion was represented by ultra-affluent families.
Just round off there, Carl.
Yeah, I was just rounding.
It's another bank right there.
It's
another big
anymore.
Bank.
But what was the... The outcome of this survey was identifying that while it doesn't sound like a large number, 5% to 12% of the families now have a large portion of their portfolio back in direct investment in private equity. Now, that's not the same thing as owning an interest in a private equity group. Mm-hmm. They are the private equity group.
Right. Right.
So they're getting into syndicates with other families and saying, we don't have to pay a private equity group. We can control performance. And again, kind of applying what we were talking about, that governance, that relationships, that risk, and that knowledge to scale that business. And sometimes it means that they are acting almost as activist investors because occasionally they will delist a publicly traded company because a lot of people aren't aware that in that small cap space, the bottom rung is $500 million, which may to you and I sound like a lot of money, but to a family that's worth $20 billion, it isn't.
Like right. The Waltons, perhaps.
So they remove all of the regulation costs, and they don't have to worry about quarterly shareholder calls any longer. They'll sit on it, they'll grow it, and then they'll make a determination whether to put it back on the market or not.
Aren't these hedge fund fees rather high also? I heard the pension funds were upset with them comparatively, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I'm sure you saw in the paper about CalPERS saying no more.
Right.
You're not performing even at least at the index level. What exactly are we paying you these basis points for, which is essentially a commission to manage money?
Mm.
Yeah, we, by the way, had a guest on recently, fascinating guest named Dan Gibbs, who's the CEO of a company called Hometown Farms. It is precisely backed by a group of very wealthy families. I won't go into details. You can actually Google it and read about it. Because we never give away confidential information, but it's direct investment by some wealthy families in businesses, and they do it because they're able to marshal their resources together and basically play on everybody's strengths to get some leverage and some scale to their investing, and it's a really neat thing to see. But Carl, you frequently mentioned you always like to talk in public about things being Greek, G-R-R-K.
Yes.
We don't spell it the right way, but it stands for governance, risk, relationships, and knowledge. We've done a great job, I think, of talking about risk. But what is governance? What are relationships? What do you mean by knowledge?
Sure. So if we take one step back and we say, okay, what is the primary goal of strategy to determine whether it's successful or not? The answer is equity value enhancement, or EVE. If you can remember EVE, equity value enhancement, that's a yardstick of strategy that works. What is governance then? Governance is the articulation of that strategy and the assurance that not only financial controls are in place, but there is strategic vision that's not looking at what's going on this quarter or next quarter, but essentially how are we going to create our new market opportunity? Not unlike some of the families that you advise, it's not let's just buy that real estate. Mm-hmm. It's okay, why are we getting this particular piece of real estate? Is it just buy low, sell high, or is there a deeper intent?
We'll get more into that, Carl.
We're going to take a quick break.
Yeah,
we're on the eve
of a commercial break, right? We'll come right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life. Stay tuned. All right, we're back with the home stretch of It's Your Money and Your Life with Carl Scheerle of the Berkley Research Group. His website is brg-expert.com, providing strategic advice and expert services globally on complex issues facing many businesses. Take over, Richard.
Carl, we were talking about governance. Obviously, governance is important because you want to have an open and transparent platform so all the constituents or stakeholders in a family business find it free to communicate and ask questions so that, like those situations where attorneys get involved, never happen. But governance typically leads to relationships. I know a lot of wealthy families tend to have relationships that are very long standing, and in many cases, the professionals that have served them haven't necessarily evolved with the families, especially as families move into third and fourth generations.
So I've written a white paper on that specific issue. If we think of governance as oftentimes being the founder and what is their vision for the wealth as it goes from one generation to the future generations, they're trying to establish a culture. It's not just the culture within the organization, but it's a culture within the family, whatever that culture is, so that it's a continuum, and that's what they usually mean when they're referring to legacy.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing that they run the risk of is that if you think of concentric circles, and in the center you have the founder and perhaps the spouse, perhaps some of the children, maybe one or two of the most trusted advisors, then you have the next circle, which is some of the other trusted advisors, maybe there's some of the family office staff, and then another circle after that. You have a bubble that's created, and they don't have the access to the knowledge, and a lot of that knowledge is born out of the relationships that they have. So one of the things that I point out in relationships is if you don't get anything from that relationship other than what you're paying for in the form of a service, it's probably not the best possible relationship for you, because that relationship should provide something above and beyond just here's your service, thank you very much.
Yeah, like preparing a tax return, preparing a living trust.
Correct. Very tactical.
Right, tactical.
But certainly not aligned, which we all experience as business owners and entrepreneurs in our own right. So that kind of rolls over to the knowledge. Because if you think about it, knowledge is all the things that are intangible in an operating business. You can't see them, but you darn well know that if it was just an assemblage of all the things that you could see, the business is only book value. It's not worth mm-hmm. anything to a third party.
Right.
So the more that you have those relationships, not only with clients, but with vendors, with trusted advisors, with personnel, with suppliers, all of those combined should give you the 1+1 equals much more than 2, and that then extends into the knowledge base. how are you differentiating? And if the answer is quality, service, cost, which everybody says that's what they do, then there isn't a strategy in place, because the strategy is supposed to drive that differentiation, making it very difficult for other people to emulate. And a very simple example is Apple. We don't know what the Apple VI was going to look like, but there was 10 million units sold in 3 days.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
600 a pop.
Now you've got a book coming out about this topic, right?
Correct.
With John Wiley and Sons. But your book is going to touch on my biggest criticism of how other professionals use valuation is they bring experts like you in too late. They bring you in after a contract has been signed, after an estate plan has been done, and they say, here's a bunch of paper. Value this thing, which is just sort of a historical measurement. What your book is about, how to actually create value, right?
Absolutely. To enhance value, to create value by leveraging all of the acronym Greek, again, governance
risk.
Relationships, risk, knowledge. It is by John Wiley and Sons, is the editor. It'll probably be in academia as well as trusted advisors, and the hope is business reporting entities as something that isn't trying to teach you how to do business valuation 101, but a lot of it's just common sense that as evaluator you see, but there are missed opportunities for incredible additional billings, but very high return on investment by the clients retaining those trusted professionals.
What will be the title of the book, Carl? Do we have a title yet?
At this juncture, and literally we just had our meeting by phone yesterday, it's Equity Value Enhancement, Governance, Relationships, Risks, Knowledge.
So if they just Google Equity Value, Carl Shaler, SH.
You may actually find it if you were to Google it, but the release date right now is May of 2015,
okay.
But my delivery date to them is in 4 weeks.
Okay.
Well,
we'll have a big signing party for you.
I think this is the thing that's most often missed in the professional community is to the extent that we can bring valuation experts in really, really early in the game, whatever the game is, estate planning, getting a business ready for sale, getting a business, shall we say, working more coherently to stay in a family for 3 or 4 generations. The earlier we bring the valuation expert in, the better.
I would like to think so. Just recently, I was retained to do a valuation, but because this is an attorney that both you and I know, said, I know that you know a lot about how the operating agreements and the bylaws can impact the value of equity. Would you look over this agreement? Tell me what you would do that would change it, because we're trying to have a reduced value of the equity so we could transfer more of that wealth.
Yeah, Carl, huge opportunity.
Carl, we have to wrap it right on for you. We're out of time,
okay.
But brg-expert.com.
Carl,
get a hold of
so
Carl
much.
Shaler. Thank you, Carl. Good seeing you, Richard. Eric Rubikoff, our sound engineer, thanks for making us
Go
sound
Chargers.
Great. Go Chargers. Thanks to Craig Blank, our account executive, and to Dave Sniff, our programming genius here. And get all the podcast at iwantmoney.com. See you next week. Good night now.